Lecture 40. Philip II, Greatest of the Kings of Europe.
Ladies and gentlemen, hello again. In our last lecture, we considered some of the social and political differences between the Macedonians and the Greeks, as well as the dismal history of Macedonia before Philip became king. We ended with a catastrophic defeat of the king before Philip, that's Perdiccas III, and several thousand Macedonian soldiers, that led to Macedonia facing four serious external threats. In this lecture, we're first going to see how Philip ended these threats by a combination of speed, diplomacy, deceit, and military force that set a pattern for his reign. But Philip knew that he'd only bought time, and that it was essential for Macedonia to have border security, unity, and above all, a proper army. In the second part of my lecture, we're going to consider his army reforms as being at the heart of his policy to bring about border security and a union of Upper and Lower Macedonia. And then third and final, we will end on how Philip's moves to enhance Macedonia's economic interests brought him into conflict with the Greeks, especially Athens. We're going to be dealing with a remarkable king, as I said before. And so I want to begin with a quote from the Greek historian Diodorus of Sicily. In the 1st century BC, Diodorus wrote a huge universal history from mythological times to Julius Caesar's conquest of Gaul in the 50s. Diodorus gives us a narrative history of Philip's reign, and at the end of it, he gives us this summary. Such was the end of Philip, who had made himself the greatest of the kings of Europe in his time. And because of the extent of his kingdom, he had made himself a throned companion of the 12 gods. He had ruled 24 years. He is known to fame as one who, with but the slenderest resources to support his claim to the throne, won for himself the greatest empire in the Greek world, while the growth of his position was not due so much to his prowess in arms as to his adroitness and cordiality in diplomacy. Philip himself is said to have been prouder of his grasp of strategy and his diplomatic successes than of valor in actual battle. Every member of his army shared in the successes which were won in the field, but he alone got credit for victories won through negotiations. This praise might seem over the top, but when we consider Philip's reign and contrast his legacy with that of his sons, Alexander the Great, I think it's right to call this praise justified. We also note from this quotation two things that Philip himself valued and that ancient writers recognized. The first was his military skill, and the second, his diplomatic ability. As we track through his reign, we'll see how brilliantly he combined the two and that they were the key to his successes. As we said in the last lecture, the situation facing Macedonia on Philip's accession in 359 was serious. Perdiccas III and 4,000 Macedonians had been killed in a battle against an invading Illyrian tribe, the Dardanians. The true heir to the throne, Perdiccas' son Amyntas, was a minor. He was underage. It doesn't really matter how old he actually was, we don't know. The fact was he was underage. So Philip, his uncle, suddenly found himself acclaimed king by the Macedonian assembly. Now, that same Illyrian tribe prepared to sweep further into Lower Macedonia, while the northern people, called the Paeonians, prepared to invade Macedonia. There was also a claimant to the throne backed by one of the kings of Thrace, and yet another pretender to the throne, this one backed by the Athenians. Well, Philip didn't flinch. In a flurry of diplomatic and other activity, he concluded some sort of armistice with the Illyrians. And this probably included his marrying Audeta, the daughter of the Illyrian chieftain. This was his second wife. He probably married for the first time while still a prince. Since the Macedonians practiced polygamy, as we've said, Philip didn't divorce the first wife to marry the second. As for the Paeonians and the Thracians, Diodorus tells us that he simply bribed them not to invade Macedonia. This apparently did the trick. The Paeonians went home and the king of Thrace withdrew his support for the pretender. That left the Athenians. They'd landed their pretender, a man called Argeus, at Methone on the Thermaic Gulf. Now this was less than 20 miles from the capital of Pella, and indeed about the same distance, give or take, from the old capital at Aegae. Accompanying Argeus was a force of 3,000 Athenian troops. Now rather than take on these troops in battle, Philip resorted to diplomacy, / deceit. All of our sources, even the hostile ones, applaud Philip's use of diplomacy. And this often amounted to trickery and outright deception. And he too apparently said that he placed more stock on his diplomacy than on fighting in Greece. And we see an excellent example of it now, of diplomacy / deceit. There had been a Macedonian garrison stationed in Amphipolis for quite some time. It had been stationed there to help it out in case the Athenians attacked Amphipolis again, trying to reconquer it. As we said in the last lecture, the Athenians wanted their former colony back. Well, Philip now, in 359 that is, withdrew that garrison. And he did this to make the Athenians think he was going to arrange for Amphipolis to be returned to them. With this carrot dangling before them, and not even thinking that they should perhaps distrust Philip, the Athenians immediately withdrew their support of Argeus, the pretender. The Athenian troops stayed put at Methone, so Argeus set off to Aegae himself with just a few supporters. Philip defeated him soon after, and he was led off to Pella to disappear from history. So within a matter of months, Philip had ended these four very serious threats to Macedonia. And it's not hard to imagine that lesser men would have fallen by the wayside. Philip also bought the necessary time to consolidate his position as king. If anyone happened to be thinking of replacing him with Amyntas, now that Macedonia seemed out of danger, or indeed making him regent of Amyntas, no one voiced that opinion. In other words, what the assembly had done remained true. Philip remained king. Since Amyntas was the legal heir to the throne in 359, but had been bypassed in favour of Philip, there might be some argument to swapping the two over now, but no argument came, and that's important. And that's actually created a lot of problems in the sources and the interpretation of them as to the relationship of Philip and Amyntas in 359. But Philip wasn't out of the woods yet, nor was Macedonia for that matter. It certainly wasn't safe from foreign incursions. Perhaps this is why no moves were made, by the way, to replace Amyntas with Philip, because the people realized that Macedonia still had a long way to go. So Philip decided that he was going to end the sorts of invasions and interference by hostile powers that had plagued Macedonia for generations, but he was going to end these once and for all. Border security at this time became his first priority. For that, he needed to unite the state by centralizing the government at Pella and by creating a proper army instead of the untrained and ill-equipped one of the peasant levies that had existed for far too long. Philip also had to replenish manpower, given that 4,000 Macedonians had been lost so recently at the hands of the Illyrians. This brings me now to the second part of my lecture, the creation of a new army for military and political reasons. From about 369 to 367 BC, so about from the age of 13 or 14 to 15 or 16, Philip had been a hostage in Thebes. He'd been sent there by his brother, King Alexander II, when Alexander had been defeated by the Thebans. Now, this was during the period of the Theban supremacy in Greece, a period that lasted from 371 to 362, which we talked about in Lecture 32. Philip experienced at first hand what military prowess can do for a state, no matter its size. And despite being a young teenager, he learned much about military strategy from those brilliant Theban generals Epaminondas and Pelopidas, but mostly from the former. It was Epaminondas who had masterminded the Thebans' victory over the Spartans at the Battle of Leuctra in 371. This was the battle that ended the Spartan hegemony of Greece. Philip also would have seen the famous Sacred Band of Thebes, an elite infantry corps of 300 men, in its daily training. He probably walked down to watch it train every day he was there. All of these experiences influenced him greatly, and when he had countered the threats to Macedonia in 359, he turned to army reform, putting into practice at least some of the experiences at Thebes. Philip's army reforms were not something that happened overnight, nor were they something that were completed within a few months or even the first few years of his reign. They continued throughout the whole of his reign, really, in the sense that as he conquered more territories, he would add foreign troops, specialists and otherwise, to his army. Some years later, probably in the late 350s, when he felt sufficiently established on the throne, he created a mechanical engineering corps, or department, and I'll talk more about that in a moment. But the point here is that these army reforms are ongoing. So we need to bear in mind that Philip was constantly adopting and adapting, but in a way that the Greeks were not. Greek infantrymen were still fighting hoplite style, for example, and they expected their enemies to do likewise. Now that was a fatal flaw in Greek thinking. Philip began by introducing new tactics and weaponry. These included switching the main attacking arm of the army from the infantry to the cavalry. Now this was the reverse of standard Greek tactics, where the hoplites would engage the enemy line first and the cavalry would follow through. Philip's cavalry would attack the flanks of the enemy first and then its infantry at the center, while the Macedonian infantry followed through. Moreover, instead of a frontal cavalry charge, Philip trained his cavalry to charge in a wedge formation on an angle to the enemy line. And this was how the Thracians and Scythian cavalry charged. The Macedonian cavalry was also arranged in squadrons or territorial units corresponding to the areas from which the men came. There was a political reason for this, as we'll come on to in a moment. Now, the cavalrymen continued to wear iron helmets and a bronze or leather cuirass. They carried the customary spear and a short sword. But Philip also created a corps of mounted scouts called the prodromoi. These were a fast strike force which Alexander would also use to great effect in Asia. The Macedonian infantry was arranged in phalanxes, like the Greek hoplite style of fighting. But Philip varied the depth of his phalanx formations from 8 ranks, this was the usual number for Greeks, by the way, to as deep as 32. He seems to have preferred, by the way, a phalanx depth of 16 ranks. Now, as with the cavalry, various infantry units were created or altered. So we have the hippaspists, a special corps of shield-bearing infantry who were lighter armed and trained to move at higher speeds than the regular infantrymen in the phalanx. The hippaspists were paid a drachma a day, and this was more than the regular soldiers. So the hippaspists may have been something of an elite force. Instead of the short stabbing sword that Greek soldiers carried, Macedonian infantrymen were trained in the use of a new weapon, the sarissa. This was a long wooden pike. Estimates vary between 14 and 18 feet long. We know it was 18 feet in the Hellenistic period, but it was certainly more than 14. It's somewhere within this length. And at the end of this long wooden pike was a pointed iron head, and it needed both hands to use. When engaging an enemy, the men lowered their sarissas and charged, jabbing these long pikes back and forth like that to kill the enemy, who couldn't even come close to the Macedonian soldiers because of the length of these sarissas. So the enemy were impaled on them. The men as a whole were rigorously trained in Philip's army. And like the Spartans in their heyday, the training was ongoing, and the soldiers served full time in the army as well. They were taught to be self-sufficient, to carry their own arms, equipment, and food. And this was obviously to their advantage when on campaign, no matter the terrain or conditions. Now, in the later Roman Republic, the term given to the soldiers of the general Marius's army was Marius's mules, because they carried so much equipment, they were like mules. But well before Marius's mules were Philip's mules. And so Macedonia obtained a professional regular army for the first time. The soldiers received pay, and they could also advance through the ranks thanks to a promotion ladder that Philip created. But Philip was also keen on technology, in his case, siege engines. He created, probably in about 350, that's, I think, when he felt secure enough on the throne of Macedonia to embark on more military reforms, he created a mechanical engineering corps. This was set up under the direction of a Thessalian man called Polyidus, who had been experimenting with new designs for siege machinery for some time. The regular type of siege machine was the mechanically drawn catapult that fired bolt heads, and Philip was using this for most of his reign. But in 340, at the siege of Byzantium, he used for the first time the torsion catapult. Now, this was far more powerful than any other catapult, and when it was fixed atop of a high siege tower, it wreaked havoc against enemy walls, against an enemy town. It was the brainchild of Polyidus, and of course, the torsion catapult revolutionized siege warfare. The Macedonian army became the most feared in the Greek world, and its cavalry and infantry were superb. It's clear that the army Philip created and his innovations in siege warfare in no small way enabled his son Alexander the Great to win the battles he did in Asia. In fact, in my lectures on Alexander, I'm going to be running the line that without Philip, no Alexander. In about the spring of 358, so a year or so after he came to power, Philip decided to trial his new army. He knew that it would only be a matter of time before his former adversaries would rear their heads again. The Paeonians might have expected the bribes to continue, for example. They probably thought that all they needed to do was to make a few noises or deploy an army, and Philip would fall over himself in his speed to give them money to keep them away. He'd done that before, he was probably going to do that again. Well, Philip had no wish to keep buying them off, of course, and besides, he was probably strapped for money at this time. I'm assuming, like many historians, that he borrowed money to hire mercenaries in the short term to make up for the 4,000 Macedonians killed in 359 and to help pay for his new army. We don't know where he borrowed the money from, where he got it from. Perhaps he borrowed it from some of the Macedonian nobles, and in return, he gave them grants of royal land. We also don't know the terms of any armistice that he concluded with the Illyrians in 359. However, if the marriage to Audata was supposed to have made him something of a puppet ruler of the Illyrian chieftain, that was clearly a position that Philip would only put up with while he regrouped. Once it became obvious to the Illyrians and the Paeonians that he was his own man, they would soon mass to invade again. Therefore, confident in his own army, even though after only a year or so of training in the new weaponry and tactics, Philip decided to invade Illyria and Paeonia. He attacked the Paeonians first, probably because they posed less danger than the Illyrians, and the morale effect of a victory on his new army would pay off dividends when it took on the far tougher Illyrians. We don't know much about the Paeonian campaign, except that Philip quickly defeated them. Then he turned to Illyria. He inflicted a massive defeat on the Illyrians. Over 7,000 of their number were killed in battle, and the Illyrians as a whole had to agree to Philip's terms. His victory over the Illyrians freed Upper Macedonia from Illyrian influence, and more importantly, it led to the union of Upper and Lower Macedonia as never before. Philip knew that the disunity between Lower and Upper Macedonia would always keep the kingdom weak. However, the strength of the Illyrians would never allow that unity while the king's army was a conscript peasant one. It was always hastily levied to face invaders, and so it was almost always on the defensive. Things would be different with a better trained and better equipped army, and Philip's successes against the Paeonians and the Illyrians proved that. At the same time, he knew that beating the Illyrians on his border was not enough. He needed to integrate them into his kingdom by centralizing the position of Pella as the capital of all Macedonia, the capital of the whole of Macedonia. His army reforms, therefore, had this political role as well. That's why Philip cannily organized the various peoples of his army by different ethnic units, but he put these together. And by putting them together, they made up the whole or the entire army. Now, what that meant was that those from different geographical areas would fight all the more fiercely to show that they were better than those in different territorial units. Somebody from Area X would want to fight harder to show he was better than someone from Area Y, and so on and so forth. But put them all together and they formed the one army. Philip knew that by being part of this larger whole, the larger whole that was the Macedonian army, people would come to accept the authority of the king of Pella over them as the commander in chief. He also knew that this and the continued military successes would foster a feeling of national unity, something again that the Macedonians had never experienced before. So the unification of Macedonia and the resulting elevation of Pella as capital of the entire kingdom were arguably Philip's greatest successes, because no king before him had ever succeeded here. And everything Philip was able to do followed on from these successes. Philip's moves to secure his borders brought him into contact with the Greeks. And in 358, the same year as he defeated the Paeonians and the Illyrians, he intervened in Thessaly. The Macedonian kings had a history of diplomatic ties with the town of Larissa, which headed something of a Thessalian league. In 358, Philip gave aid to Larissa against its traditional enemy, the town of Pherae. Now, Larissa and Ferry had been at loggerheads with each other for decades. Ferry wanted to reassert its authority in Thessaly. This would be at the expense of Larissa, and hence Larissa wanted to keep Ferry down, and Ferry wanted to reassert the sort of power it used to have decades ago. Now, a more formal alliance with Larissa made perfect sense at this time for Philip. For one thing, he needed any ally he could get at this critical time in his early kingship. You know, let's be realistic. Also, Thessaly was a fertile area with the best horses in Greece, and these Philip used for his cavalry. Finally, Thessaly bordered Macedonia to the south, and hence his alliance with Larissa meant that he'd now secured his southern border. This alliance was cemented by his marrying a woman from Larissa named Philina. This was his third marriage. She gave birth a year later, in 357, to a son, Arrhidaeus. Alexander, then, was not the eldest son, but you'll have to wait and see why Alexander succeeded Philip and Arrhidaeus didn't. Philip had only his eastern and southwestern borders to worry about now. He'd started to reduce the Greek presence along the Macedonian coastline, along the Thermaic Gulf, something that he'd continued to do over the next few years. And for now, Thrace to his east was held in check. Therefore, in 357, he turned to his southwestern border. He struck an alliance with the king of Epirus, which included his marriage, his fourth, to the princess Olympias. The following year, Olympias gave birth to a son, Alexander, the future Alexander the Great. We can see then how much a part of the pattern of diplomacy was Philip's use of political marriages. The earliest ones were all to do with securing the borders of Macedonia. Further expansion could now follow, but this would bring him into conflict with the Greeks, especially the Athenians. And it's on this note that I end my lecture. In 359, as we said, Philip withdrew the Macedonian garrison from Amphipolis, but he never intended to return the place to Athens. By 357, the time of his marriage to Olympias, the securing of the southwestern border, this alliance with Epirus, Philip had become involved in the rich mining regions close to Amphipolis. And this set in motion his moves to stimulate Macedonia's economy like never before. Mining became fundamental to the Macedonian economy because the gold and silver were turned into coinage. By the end of his reign, in 336, the Macedonian economy was very strong and its coinage was the strongest in Europe. Now, the Athenians had a long history of interfering in Macedonian politics, so Philip couldn't allow them any influence in this northern area. Hence, in 357, Philip decided that he was going to seize Amphipolis and keep it. And when the Athenians realized that he'd duped them, they declared war on him. Now, Philip must have known that the Athenians would have this reaction. So the big question is whether he provoked this war as a means of involving himself more in Greek affairs. In other words, even after only 2 or 3 years on the throne, did he feel sufficiently comfortable to think about interfering in affairs south of Mount Olympus in central Greece? But the opportunity for him to do that, for him to involve Macedonia in central Greek affairs, didn't come with this war against Athens. It came with what's called the Third Sacred War. And this Third Sacred War was fought over the Oracle of Apollo at Delphi. It broke out in 355 BC. And by the time it ended in 346, so about a decade later, Philip had become an influential power in central Greek affairs. And Macedonia was nowhere near the backwater that it had been when he became king in 359. Now, how Philip achieved all of this, how he exploited this Third Sacred War, how he came to be a power in central Greek politics is what we're going to be discussing in our next lecture on Philip. Thank you very much indeed.